So that tiny little cable holds this whole thing up, huh?
Yeah, it's actually it's not as small a cable as you would think. It's about 6 feet away from you, so it's
you know, I have no depth perception.
Well, that's probably part of the problem, but it's probably a good inch and a half thick.
Oh, hi, it's John Hodgman and Jonathan Colton here. We're currently on the Roosevelt Island tram, which is sort of like a zip line with a giant Lego attached to it, and apparently people ride on this all the time.
They do, and I can see why. It's lovely.
And not just Swiss people, like regular Americans.
Regular Americans and...
Not just gondoliers.
No, there are probably some Swiss people, but it's not exclusively Swiss people.
Now, I think it's very lovely and frightening, but I'm not really sure. This goes from Roosevelt Island to Manhattan, so why aren't we going to Brooklyn? Isn't that where we're going for our little Grey Book lecture?
Yeah, but the you don't live in Brooklyn, so you don't know this, but when you're in Brooklyn, it's actually impossible to get from Brooklyn to another place in Brooklyn directly. You have to go... You always have to go through Manhattan.
Oh, one way or the other?
One way or the other, yeah.
I see. Hmm. Well, it's still very frightening.
It is. Well, it's very breezy, and you know, it's a long trip. It goes over the water. I don't know.
Don't you think we should move off the roof and into the area with seats and people in it?
It's a very nice day, and we've set up these chairs, and we have this picnic lunch. We might as well enjoy it.
I'm not sure I would call these chairs
stools.
Kind of more some sticks that you salvaged from the ruined hospital where we were moored when your submarine ran out of gas.
Waste not, want not.
Well, in any case, you've set up the memory aquaphone so handily there beneath the zip line of the tram that maybe we should listen to another piece of the Little Grey Book Lectures past.
I think that's a fine idea.
And I don't know if the dial goes this far back, but I think we should go all the way back to Little Grey Book Lecture number 2.
Oh, my.
Which was indeed a long time ago. As you might imagine, it was our second Little Grey Book Lecture.
Mm-hmm.
The subject was hints on public singing. And you may recall this was the first one that we had ever done with music.
Yeah.
I had met you about 24 hours before.
Right.
Panhandling on a gondola in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And I didn't get on it at the time, but you loved going up and down in that thing. And you were singing.
It was fun.
You were really good at singing songs, and every day you would write a different gondola-themed song going to the top of a mountain.
Yeah, that wore thin after a while, believe it or not.
Yeah, well, but, you know, you could do it in Italian and German and Romanche.
Yes.
So, you know, you could rotate through a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, three times each day.
And I can understand Esperanto, but I can't speak it.
Right, of course. No one can really understand it unless they've lived there.
Right.
Yeah. But at any rate, so the idea was that we would have everyone come and speak on a subject that they were interested in, and then we would have the audience then all sing a song together as led by the lecturer, and you giving them musical prompts with a instrument called a guitar.
Yes, that was the plan.
And it was very nerve-wracking, we discovered, which was sort of the point. The whole lecture was inspired by the fact that it is obvious that there is not enough singing, especially in bars, and we were trying to, you know, bring that back again to some degree. People are uncomfortable singing, and we were hoping that if enough people were embarrassing themselves, they would sing along, and so they did. So it was our sing-along lecture.
Yeah, and I certainly embarrassed myself, so...
Well, still, you were just back here from another country. You were born here, but you grew up in Switzerland, and... And you hosted various European rock video programs for a long time in Europe.
Yeah.
And then you came back here for a short time to be one of the early VJs on MTV.
Right.
And then you had gone back to Europe to host a Top 30 Countdown radio program.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got this job writing themed gondola songs going up mountains in Switzerland.
Yeah, when you put it that way, it does seem like a pretty great life.
See, it was great, but you decided to come back and do this show, and due to some passport problems that you had, you were forced to become my indentured servant.
Yeah. I've never looked back, though, really, until now.
Sorry, I didn't mean to bring it up or make you uncomfortable, because there's really nothing you can do about it at this point.
Yeah. Are you going to eat that deviled egg?
Not that one.
Okay.
So, at any rate, here Brett Martin, one of our regular contributors to the Little Grey Book Lectures, introduces indeed the very idea of the sing-along and how it was introduced originally to the American public by the Fleischer brothers of the Fleischer Animation Studios, which had created in the early part of the last century Coco the Clown and Betty Boop, and the first Popeye cartoons were by the Fleischers, and as well as the first Superman cartoons. And they also invented something very interesting regarding following a bouncing ball.
I will read from his application for patent 1,573,696. Be it known that I, Max Fleischer, a citizen of the United States and a resident of the city of New York, borough of Brooklyn, in the county of Kings and state of New York, have invented a new and improved song motion picture film. The problem with current sing-along technology, he points out, is that, quote, the means employed to guide the patrons in singing with the music has been based on the idea of merely shifting the indicating mark from word to word with a view to bringing about uniformity in the singing of the words. Which method, he goes on, does not take cognizance of the fact that with a number of singers, there will be great variation in the starting of the singing, as well as in the singing of a particular word or syllable. This was a problem that had vexed many. And the answer is the bouncing ball, which is seen here in the patent. It's a little hard to read, but the song is Daisy, Daisy, Give Me Your Answer, Do. In the beginning, the ball was not actually animated. The Fleischers would simply write the lyrics to popular songs on the side of a washing machine drum and then film one of them with a ball on a stick, bouncing it from syllable to syllable. The ever-enterprising, ever-sporting Sam Potts was kind enough to demonstrate this for us for a popular Van Halen song. He was just wearing that, weirdly enough. Sam, by the way, also produced many of these slides by hand with an X-Acto blade, because he's crazy. Okay, meanwhile, using this, Coco's cartoons debuted in 1924 at either the Rialto or the Circle Theater, it's not quite clear which, with the song O Mabel by Gus Kahn and Ted Fiorito. It was quickly followed by Trarara Boomdie, In the State of the Old Apple Tree, Mother, 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 Pin a Rose on Me, Come Take a Trip in My Airship, When the Midnight Choo-Choo Comes to Alabama, and Yaka Hula Hika Ula. And several others. Many, many others, in fact. The first sound cartoon was not as is commonly thought, Steamboat Willie, but it was a cartoon for Old Kentucky Home. If there was a word to describe the American public reaction to these cartoons, that word would be apeshit. They mobbed the theaters, and apparently the applause would last straight through into the feature. This was the last great moment in sing-alongs, in fact, if I can just digress for just a moment. Until 1970, when a young aspiring drummer in Kobe, Japan, named Daisuke Inoue, who couldn't read a note of music and could barely play it, used some money borrowed from his father, a pancake salesman, and fiddling around in his garage came up with the karaoke machine, a process recreated by Sam Potts here. Incidentally, neglected to file a patent for his invention, and he never made a dime from it, although he was named by Time Asia as one of the 10 most influential Asians of the 20th century, alongside Gandhi, the Dalai Lama, Mao Zedong, and Pol Pot. Anybody who's ever seen seven shit-faced frat boys working their way through My Way will understand that last comparison. And, of course, the next great moment in sing-along with the debut of punk rock and heavy metal karaoke scene,
Mondays at the Continental.
But to return to the Fleischers, they are now stuck with the question, how do you follow the bouncing ball? Brilliantly, as it turned out, the Fleischers were one of the few animators of the time to make the successful leap to talkies. They created Bimbo, a dog that starred in many cartoons, including one in 1931 that featured a little girl dog with nice legs that quickly grew into Betty Boop. In 1933, they debuted the animated Popeye the Sailor Man, and in 1936, the first feature-length cartoon, Popeye the Sailor Meets Sinbad the Sailor, a full year before Snow White, mind you. In 1941, they also debuted the first animated Superman, and it was a Fleischer cartoon that first used the phrase, look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, et cetera, et cetera. Fleischer Studios, in fact, was Walt Disney's major and only rival at this time. Disney was out in sunny California, of course, while Fleischer remained here in New York, and I think it shows. Their stuff is darker, it's weirder, it's a little more surreal. If you want to get a sense of what I mean, consider, I'm sure you can all get a mental picture of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. Fleischer had Samson Mouse, which is clearly the way a New Yorker would view a mouse, and Dora Duck, obviously drawn by someone not overly familiar with ducks. There was also Ferdinand Frog and Gus Gorilla, neither of which will be in any Happy Meals anytime soon. Disney made Cinderella, they made Snow White. Fleischer did a short with Cab Calloway, in which Calloway was rotoscoped into a, quote, ghost walrus, singing Minnie the Moocher, which is about a cocaine addict. And they also had Louis Armstrong singing a song that went, you gave my wife a Coca-Cola so she'd let you play on her viola, which was not made into a bouncing ball cartoon. But, what's up there? Brotherhood, you can just ask Shakespeare or Jeb Bush, is a tricky business. It is said that as Fleischer Studios grew, Max became something of a tyrant. He was given to saying things like, that's so good you'd think I'd done it. When the animators at Fleischer Studios attempted to form a union, Max busted it. Dave had always claimed that he was the one who was actually responsible for the rotoscope and that Max was siphoning money off to a secret account. Max spread rumors that Dave was having an extramarital affair with his secretary. Joe, meanwhile, had stewed in his own juices for decades. He said, I always thought that if I hung around long enough, Max would notice me. Max never did. Lewis tried to keep the peace, but it was too late. In 1942, partly because of the squabbling, Paramount Pictures foreclosed on a $100,000 loan they had made to the Fleischers, and they took it away, renaming it Famous Studios, which turned out anemic imitations of other cartoons, such as Baby Huey, which was modeled on Chuck Jones's Three Bears, Herman and Catnip, which bore a striking resemblance to Tom and Jerry, and Casper the Friendly Ghost, which just plain sucked. No, it sucked. I'm sorry. Max, meanwhile, lived out his life making army training videos like Popeye Meets Eugene the Jeep. Lewis became a lens grinder, and Dave always said that he wanted to write a book called There's No Greater Love, Hate Than Brotherly Love. Still, no matter how this thing ended, the Fleischers need to be remembered for their one shining moment in American history, because I think the bouncing ball is truly technology used to the very best of ends. You'll find very, very many useful patents in the U.S. Patent Office, but there are very few as happy as old 1,573,696, which is, I think, a declaration of independence of sorts. It said, join us. These songs, this culture, it belongs to everybody. It said, go ahead, sing. Singing is not just for those blessed at birth with perfect pitch or the money for singing lessons or a great memory for lyrics. Singing is not, all due respect, Mrs. Barnum, for the Swedish nightingales of the world. It is also for we bearded ladies, we dog-faced boys. Singing is not for the few, it is for the many, and what's more, it is for the many all at the same time. And so we're going to give it a try, though we are few. I'm going to go first because I'm a professional. bump, de-dum, be-dumb, be-bump, de-dum. Got it? Bump, de-dum, be-dumb, be-bump, de-dum. Bump, de-dum, be-dum, be-bump, de-dum. Okay. You got the point, right? This is the ball. It's my fault. Ready? Bump, de-dum, be-dum, be-bump, de-dum. 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 Bump, de-dum, be-dum, be-bump, de-dum.
What's on the other side? Rainbows are visions and only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. Dreamers and me. Who said that every wish would be heard and granted? Wished on a morning star. Somebody thought of that. So amazing that keeps us stargazing.
And what do we hope we will see? Someday we'll find it. The rainbow connection. The lovers,
the dreamers, and me. All of us under its spell.
Of course, when you know, when Brett Martin and the audience and you sing a song from the Muppet movie, that mm-hmm. I just want to be clear that constitutes fair use under copyright law. So no one can sue us
sure
for that.
I'm not sure I understand how is that fair use.
Well, of course it wasn't just you singing; it was a lot of people. So you can't sue all of those people.
Well, that's true.
And more importantly, but we're on a tram right now. So it's international waters.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
It's a little loophole.
Right.
But, you know, you can't sue. It would be a frivolous lawsuit for someone to sue us for using that song.
I guess so.
Because it's fair use.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
And then, of course, a little later in that program, when Elizabeth Gilbert, on the other hand, read from her profile of Hank Williams III, the country music artist, Hank Williams.
And that is not fair use.
No, that was copyright, and that was copyright infringement at that time. It had appeared in Gentleman's Quarterly Magazine,
right,
which is a monthly magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they're innocent. They're misleading people.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they technically owned it, and at that time, that was technically copyright infringement.
Right.
Insofar as I believe they owned the performance in Williamsburg rights to that piece.
Right.
You know, we didn't get in trouble. Now, of course, for us to replay a portion of it, it is fair use.
Right.
And again, for two reasons. One, because we're only replaying a portion of it. And two, that was 75 years ago, so it's now in the public domain.
Yeah.
I used to be a rights professional, you see.
So. I think you should go back to law school.
I never went to law school.
That's sort of my point.
I was working in a business where I would read and vet legal contracts, but I was not an attorney, nor did I have any training in contracts or legality.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is technically not true, and nor is it enforceable.
Right.
Technically.
Okay.
At any rate, you'll enjoy this, and you'll also hear another song again, which is wholly fair use. And it's all because it's at least 75 to 150 years old ago that this lecture occurred.
Right.
Public domain.
Public domain.
Wretched, lonely, broke, drunk, physically depleted, it was all coming together for Hank III. And then, just to make things even more country music perfect, he actually had to sell off his pickup truck in order to pay his bills. And then his dog up and died on him. Right in front of his eyes. The kindly gods of Nashville were obviously smiling down on him. Hank Williams III, country music star, had arrived. And now a song.
Hear the lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is winding low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I'd never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind a cloud to hide its face and did you ever see a robin weep when leaves begin to die? That means he's lost the will to live. I'm so lonesome.
That's a beautiful song, Jonathan. Do you remember playing that song?
I sure do.
Well, we're coming to you now again from the top of the tram on the way from Roosevelt Island to Manhattan, making our way back to Williamsburg for our next little Gray Book lecture, which is number 30 on how to observe President's Day observed. That's for February, which day?
24th.
And at what time?
7:30.
And where should people be?
The future.
And if they are not there, what will they be?
Sorry.
Yes, I agree. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. But we won't see you. Nor will we hear you in the future.
Correct.
The silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky. And I sorry.